We are talking once again with Jaw Parrish and Maria Tomchick, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Happy birthday to us.
Yes. Happy birthday to the both of you.
Yes.
Yes.
It's our birthday week.
Yes, we are not. Week? We're not twins.
we were not born on the same day, but no, close.
But very close, yes. Uh-huh.
Just a few years apart, though.
Yeah, a few years apart.
And a few miles apart, too. All right. We talked about the election results last week and no real changes to report.
Yeah, no big changes to what we reported last week. The only upset was Hamdi Mohamed and Chika Grace Asagawa unseating the incumbent Stephanie Bowman and Peter Steinbrück in the Port of Seattle races. So it looks like going into 2022, we're going to have Bruce Harrell as mayor and Ann Davison as city attorney.
Yeah, the only possible, unlikely but possible change was in the city attorney race, and Nicole Thomas Kennedy gained a little bit, but not nearly enough. She's 3% back as opposed to 4% back last week.
Yeah.
There's just not enough votes left to make that difference up.
And when you think about the position she initially ran on, it's kind of amazing that she got so close to winning, I think, that she pushed out Pete Holmes in the primaries and then got this close to winning, I think.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's remarkable that Ann Davison actually won. And I think both of those were due to the fact that, you know, they're kind of the extremes of what's possible in Seattle politics. You know, Nicole Thomas Kennedy, initially ran an abolitionist platform, which is certainly not mainstream, at least outside the city of Seattle. And Ann Davison, you know, the Trump Republican, managed to get the business community behind her, and she's going to be city attorney, which ought to be concerning for a lot of people.
She did a pretty good job of camouflaging who she actually is this time around. It's as if it took a couple of trial runs for her to figure out that that's what she needed to do in order to win.
Yeah, and I think we're going to find out who she really is once she's city attorney.
Yeah.
It's very concerning. And it's certainly not Bruce Harrell's going to rein her in, or vice versa.
Yeah. So we'll see how the city council and how the business community responds to the fact that they backed someone who is that extreme.
Yep.
Yeah, and a big congratulations to all the real estate moguls that contributed heavily to those campaigns, and I know they're sleeping a lot better this week, knowing that the levers at City Hall will be flipping in their direction.
The best elected officials that money can buy.
Yeah. Now Sarah Nelson won the council 9 seat over Nikita Oliver. Again, that margin between them narrowed, but not enough for Nikita to pull ahead. So that adds one more pro business person to the city council, to Alex Peterson, who tends to lean in that direction, and Deborah Juarez, who definitely leans in that direction. But it's not enough for them to have a majority. Some folks have said that may tilt other council members in their direction, Andrew Lewis perhaps, or Dan Strauss perhaps, but I'm not convinced of that. I still think we have a fairly progressive crew on city council.
Yeah, agreed. And I think we've already seen who Dan Strauss and Andrew Lewis are, and they are not automatic votes for the business community, which is what the business community wants. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got 7 seats that will be up for election in 2023. And I expect that business community is going to pour a lot of money into those races.
Yeah, and that those are going to be hard-fought races with a lot of PAC money in them. And that's also quite discouraging.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
All right.
it'll be interesting to see how things work between the legislative body in the city council, and the mayor and the city attorney. Because I think we've been used to having a city attorney that kind of goes along with the city council, and not necessarily the mayor. It'll be interesting to see the reverse of that.
And bear in mind, I mean, we've got the precedent now with Jenny Durkin of the mayor pretty much ignoring the council's budget with programs that she didn't like and spending money on programs she does like instead. Mm-hmm. I think Bruce Harrell is very likely to expand on that precedent.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting, too, to see if Ann Davison does that in the city attorney's office. I think we can expect that next month in December, when the city council wraps up its business for the year and passes maybe a few more ordinances, that they will be discussing and trying to pass an ordinance to make diversion programs a permanent part of the city attorney's office and duties, in an effort to keep Ann Davison from cutting funding to things like the LEAD program and other diversion programs. So I think we can definitely expect that to happen in December.
Yeah. All right. Well, so speaking of the city budget.
You first want to touch on Seattle City Light?
Oh, yeah. There was interesting, I wouldn't say development, because it's not necessarily new, but it's getting more attention this week. The green certification that Seattle City Light has been bragging about for years and years and years around the Skagit River dams is being called into question. And the reason it's being called into question, of course, is that one of the criteria for that green certification is fish passage, which of course the dams in Skagit River, along with many other places, are terrible for fish passage. They do not allow salmon runs to go upstream, or a very limited capacity to go upstream.
And I think those dams were built in the 1930s, long before the requirement for fish passage was there.
And yeah, we can't say fish passage like five times fast. the thing is, the green certification also happened like 20 years ago, and the science has advanced quite a bit since then. And so you've got the Skagit Valley Indian tribes and various other stakeholders, environmental nonprofits, and so forth, challenging that green certification. Seattle City Light has been bragging for years that not only do they have green certification for those dams, but it is the largest such project that has green certification in the country. And it probably shouldn't. But we'll keep an eye on that, because I think that's going to be legally challenged here very soon.
All right. Well, back to city council and budgeting analysis, which Ray has been following for several weeks now.
Yeah, and this week on Wednesday, Teresa Mosqueda announced her balancing package for the city budget. But first, the council reviewed the new revenue projections for 2022. And it turns out that sales taxes and business and operations taxes are lower than expected. This is the money that flows directly into the general fund, which the council can spend however and wherever they want. That was bad news. But the good news is that the gap was mostly filled in by an increase in the real estate excise tax, or REIT tax, collections. It turns out that the city's housing and commercial development has continued to boom even during the pandemic lockdown. So the real estate market is still going strong. So the overall shortfall in city revenues is only about $1.4 million, and that's like a rounding error in the city budget. It's so small. Still, this required Teresa Mosqueda to draft some additional amendments to shift money around, since REIT funds can only be used for certain things. she shifted a bunch of it into the Seattle Department of Transportation, into the Parks Department and the Finance General Department to free up money to fill the gap in the general fund. And then she really lit into the city budget office, because instead of using a conservative worst case scenario to estimate 2022 revenues in August, like they've been doing throughout 2021, they use the normal baseline case, which assumes that the local economy will be back to business as usual in 2022. This allowed Mayor Durkin to have extra revenue to allocate wherever she wanted in her draft budget. Even though the total shortfall has turned out to be small by using the baseline, it might not have been that way if the property markets had also slowed along with the rest of the economy. So Mosqueda, I think, was right to be angry about that. The council has pretty narrowly averted a disaster in which they would have had to make several deep cuts to the mayor's budget. Of course, then Mayor Durkin would have been able to beat her chest and call the council the bad guys, right? So you can see how the mayor's office may have put pressure on the city budget office to use the baseline rather than to use the worst case scenario like they've been doing for the last year and a half. And so instead of having extra revenue that the city council could have used to fund their amendments, if Durkin had drafted her budget using the worst case scenario, Durkin just hopped to the, let's assume next year's business as usual and I've got extra money I can put to what I want. Then the council will have to cut here and there and I can call them the bad guys, which is what she's been doing, right? So then Mosqueda released her balancing package, in which she took the almost 200 amendments and tried to fit in as many as she could and still make the budget balance. And she did a pretty good job. Most of the amendments that we've talked about so far are in the balancing package, but a lot of them have lower funding. So here are some examples. Sawant's amendment to allocate efforts to allocate $4.6 million to create new safe parking lots for people living in cars and RVs has been cut down to about $1.4 million. Dan Strauss's request to spend $700,000 on outreach to people living in RVs is now cut down to about $100,000. So that's a big cut there. Andrew Lewis's request to spend $7.6 million on a peer navigator system for the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. We talked about that a little bit last week, has been slashed down to a request for more information about the program before the council will spend any money on it. So that $7.6 million is completely out. Andrew Lewis's request for $20.9 million for a high acuity homeless shelter with medical and behavioral health services has been cut down to $5 million, so a little less than a quarter of what he requested for it.
Yeah, and that money will not go very far for those kind of services.
Yeah, it may go to shelters that already exist to simply add those services to those shelters. Yeah.
Those services are very expensive.
Yeah. Now, Lorena Gonzalez's request for $750,000 for a pilot guaranteed basic income program has been cut down to $200,000, so a little less than a third of what she requested. So that's going to be a very small pilot program. Morales's request for $2 million for a restorative justice program has been shaved down to $500,000, about a quarter of what she requested for that. Lisa Herbold's request to add $14.6 million to fully fund pre-arrest diversion programs, which would have been great to do, has been cut down to $3.5 million. So once again, LEAD and other diversion programs are not getting the full funding that they need in order to be extended citywide and to all folks who qualify, which is unfortunate. And the three amendments that would have allocated about $47.4 million for mental and behavioral health services citywide have been cut down to $2.86 million, plus a resolution to request more money from the state and federal governments. So That's, I think, I talked about that last week, the mental and behavioral health, the money for mental and behavioral health in the budget, and how it was an admission that the state and federal government have really fallen short in funding mental health services for the city of, for the city of Seattle, for the state, you know, and that the city was, that the city council was hoping to step up. But, those amendments that, that had a lot of funding behind them are now cut way down from 47.4 million to 2.86 million. So once again, wow, mental health services, you know, kind of falling by the wayside.
When in fact, that's one of the things we constantly hear.
One of the biggest needs
for
public
safety. From both sides. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
From like everyone involved. So.
Yeah. Now, I think it's really interesting. One of the reasons I like to cover the amendments that, and the requests that city council members make even before the balancing package is released, is because it's super interesting to see what each council member hopes to get added into the budget. And, you know, they know that they're not going to get everything they want, but it's really a look at what their priorities are and what the city has been hearing and the council has been hearing from constituents about what the needs are in Seattle. And then, of course, when we talk about the balancing package, we get to see what, you know, the needs there, but the money isn't.
Okay. And the fact that the money's not there, I mean, we'll talk about the pandemic in a minute, mm-hmm, but that is not going away, and it's probably not going away in 2022 either.
Yeah.
So I
think it raises the question of, can the council or will the council find new revenue sources? It's a little late in the process this year for next year's budget to do it, but I think it's something that they may revisit in 2022. Just like they did this year when they passed the Jumpstart payroll tax. They revisited last year's budget and said, you know, we need a new source of revenue.
Yep.
And that's where the Jumpstart payroll tax originated. Now, as for the Seattle Police Department budget, the amendments that Mosqueda included in the balancing package would cut a total of $10.86 million in salary savings, hiring incentives, and technology projects. This represents just 3% of the department's total budget. The cut would not lead to the loss of any current positions in the Seattle Police Department, in spite of what you may have read in the Seattle Times or heard from Mayor Durkan or Interim Chief Diaz saying that 30 positions will have to be cut. That's not true. The cuts assume that the Seattle Police Department won't be able to hire as many officers as they say they can, and that attrition will be higher than they're predicting. Now, remember, the SPD has routinely told the council that they can hire more officers than they actually do and that they're actually able to do. The same is true for attrition. The Seattle Police Department reps routinely underestimate how many officers they're going to lose in a year. That's been true, you know, for as many years as I can remember. So Mosqueda took a look at, okay, you know, what is the Seattle Police Department actually been able to do? And she figured out X amount of salary savings, you know, X amount of hiring incentives the city council can claw back. Now, of course, Mayor Durkan couldn't help sending out a press release where she mischaracterized this year's budget, 2021 budget for Seattle Police Department as a layoff budget, which is not true. She then blamed the council for the loss of 325 police officers who left the department this year. Again, that's not true. And she repeats the lie that the council has promised to cut the Seattle Police Department by 50%. And no, that's not true either. Some council members have said that they would consider it along with beefing up community safety funding.
That will be a process that would take years.
Yes, and they have
what they're said talking that. What they're talking they about is reimagining how we do public safety.
Yeah.
And changing the priorities. But it's not the same.
Yeah, having Durkan mischaracterize the budget that way is really unfortunate, but it's something we're going to continue to see next year with Bruce Harrell as as mayor. Now, this 2022 budget would fully fund current Seattle Police Department salaries, so no cuts are there, and it would provide a reasonable amount for new hires, not an exorbitant amount that leaves a windfall for the Seattle Police Department to spend on things like excessive overtime. In the past, we've seen some officers collect more overtime in a week than they could potentially work, even if they never went home for the night. Okay. It would prevent the Seattle Police Department from paying hazard pay or, you know, essentially bonuses, automatic bonuses to their officers. And it would prevent the SPD from spending money on undefined technology in quote unquote technology investments and to purchase more crowd control weapons. So those are things that the council has had legitimate concerns about. And they are trying to prevent the Seattle Police Department from requesting and receiving a huge amount for salary to cover salary and then be able to take what's left over after they pay salaries and just spend it however they want. That's why the 10%, that's why the $10.86 million cut, which is a 3% cut to the Seattle Police Department.
And then that comes after years and years of budget increases
mm-hmm.
that were pretty much rubber stamped.
Some of them double digit budget. Yeah, some of them double digit budget increases.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about city budget amendments for the two remaining large groupings of where the city budget falls into. I've talked about the public safety aspects of the budget. I've talked about the amendments that cover kind of the human needs portion of the budget. And I want to talk about infrastructure and the arts budgets. And this will be a little bit quicker. This week, I'm really talking about the departments that include like the Seattle Department of Transportation, the Public Utilities, City Light, the Seattle Public Library, and the arts funding. And I'll take them one by one by department. The Seattle Department of Transportation, there were 17 original amendments proposed. Not all of them made it into the balancing package, but of the ones that request additional funding, most of those did. But the source of that funding was changed from the transportation fund, which has money from the general fund as well as from transportation levy. And that the funding source was changed to REIT funds, so the real estate excise tax can be spent there. And this allows the council to shift some general fund money out of the transportation department to other spending priorities. So some of the amendments that survived include a small increase in the commercial parking tax from 12.5% to 14.5%. This will allow the city council to raise some additional revenue. Proceeds of about $2.4 million will be split evenly between the structure major maintenance account and Vision Zero, which is the city's project to reduce pedestrian fatalities. That was Andrew Lewis who proposed that. A separate council bill number 120198, to issue $100 million in bonds for bridge rehabilitation projects, which was proposed by Alex Peterson, also has made it into the balancing package. So that's good news for folks who are concerned about not just the West Seattle Bridge, but other bridges in the city that desperately need maintenance.
Oh, like the University Bridge, which is currently in the upright position.
Stuck
on game
open.
Day. Yeah.
Yeah, on game day when we really need it to be functioning. Yes, indeed. So that's something that I think is going to pass this year just for that reason.
Maybe they engineered that just for that reason.
I don't know. Another amendment that's in there is a proviso or a set of restrictions on $2.5 million inside the Seattle Department of Transportation budget to only be spent on the citywide integrated transportation plan. That's an effort to integrate the separate pedestrian master plan, the separate bicycle master plan, the freight master plan, and the transit master plan. And I have to say, it's about time. We need an integrated plan. That was proposed by Lorena Gonzalez. And her co-sponsors were Tammy Morales, Alex Peterson, Dan Strauss, Andrew Lewis, and Teresa Mosqueda. So
which indicates it's going to pass. Yeah.
Yeah. Which means that instead of just having two co-sponsors, she had several, and this is a top priority. Now, most of the rest of the amendments are for smaller projects within each district, things like redesigns of Lake Washington Boulevard, pedestrian improvements on Ballard Avenue Northwest, improvements to MLK Way, adding money to the Market to Mohai project, improvements to Northeast 45th where it crosses I-5, new sidewalks in District 2, which is Tammy Morales' district in Southeast Seattle, et cetera, et cetera. And those are all in there, and they're mostly being funded with real estate excise tax funds. Okay. So that's the Seattle Department of Transportation. Maybe you've read in the Seattle Times and other news sources, there is funding in the Department of Transportation to update the design for the city center connector streetcar. It's not money to build it. It's basically an acknowledgement that the design is now 4 years old, was completed in 2018. And there's probably additional costs involved now, and things have changed in the downtown core, so it's time to go back and redesign it, or at least update the design. So there's some money in the budget for that. We'll see if Bruce Harrell likes the idea of the city center streetcar. Durkin wasn't fond of it. She put it on hold. We'll see if Harrell decides to go full blast and propose to spend money on actually building it. Now, the Seattle Public Utilities budget, there were four amendments to the SPU budget. All four are in the balancing package, plus two additional amendments. It includes $1 million for RV wastewater and cleanup services for homeless folks living in their RVs. That was proposed by Shama Sawant. $100,000 set aside for hygiene services for Camp Second Chance in West Seattle. That was Lisa Herbold. $175,000 for International District cleanup of graffiti and trash pickup. That was Tammy Morales's. A study of flooding along Finney Avenue North from 125th to 130th Streets, and a report on potential drainage improvements in that area. That was Deborah Juarez. And then two new amendments, a separate council bill to issue up to $88 million in 30-year fixed-rate bonds to pay for capital improvements to the city's drainage and wastewater system. As you can see, if you've been out and about this weekend, there are some areas of the city that have drainage issues and may need some help. And then a second separate council bill to issue up to $88 million in 30-year fixed-rate bonds to pay for capital improvements to the city's municipal water system. So that's the delivery of fresh water to customers, including our drinking water. So that's the Seattle Public Utilities budget. A lot of it devoted to the cleaning up our city of graffiti and trash and improving water delivery and water drainage.
Yeah.
Seattle City Light only had one amendment. That was from Dan Strauss. It was a small amendment, $160,000 to add street lighting to a portion of Northwest 48th Street and the adjoining alleys. I think it's around 8th Avenue Northwest. The Seattle Parks and Recreation had 12 amendments originally to increase funding for various parks and sports programs. Seven of those amendments made it into the balancing package, including, these are just the big items, $3.1 million of one-time COVID relief funds to continue the Clean City Initiative through the end of next year, which would clean up parks and public spaces of trash, graffiti, pick up sharps, objects, and so forth. There was money in Mayor Durkin's budget to do that through the summer, but not to the end of the year. This would add enough to go through the end of 2022, $1 million for park remediation work to restore areas damaged by overuse during the pandemic lockdown. So a lot of us didn't have anywhere to go, really, when we needed to get out of the house or get away from roommates or partners. And going to the park was the one place everyone could go. And our parks saw a lot of overuse and some damage because of that. So this would do things like plant grass, to plant trees, to, you know, fix trails, to help with fires that got out of control and barbecue pits and so forth.
Do you anticipate any of the money going towards the numerous restrooms that had been closed over the last year or two in the parks?
Yeah, that would be a good idea, but I don't see additional money that is being added as an amendment to the budget. I'm sure there's probably money in the budget that Durkin proposed for that.
Okay.
Another amendment is for $1 million for a new playground at Ballard Commons Park and $414,000 for a bike and pedestrian trail at the Chiesti Green Space. That's at the southeast tip of Jefferson Park. So some nice improvements there for the Seattle parks, as well as additional money to help with cleanup. Some of that money may go into fixing some of the restrooms that, because they've been out of order or closed for a long period of time, might need repairs or upgrades.
Yeah.
Now, Seattle Public Library had two amendments, both from Alex Peterson. One is for $99,000 to add more Wi-Fi hotspots that can be checked out and used by library patrons for 3 weeks at a time. Currently, the library system has 675 hotspot devices that they can check out, and they're in extremely high demand. And this money will add more of those for.
Wow.
Yeah, I bet you didn't know.
That's wild. Yeah,
that the library had those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blows my mind.
And that can be a lifeline for people who don't have housing.
Yes. For people who don't have the money to install a Wi-Fi system or, you know, just have an internet modem and only one way for one device to plug in. If they have kids at home who need to do remote learning, as well as adults who need to remote work, having a hotspot can be a lifesaver.
Yeah. Okay. Imagine if we had a municipal internet service here that
if we treated, you know, internet access like a utility, which it really is at this point.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And your landlord or your home would come with that stuff pre-installed.
Yeah, because you can't really work these days without access to the internet.
I know.
But for some reason, we've left that in the hands of private business, which is not working out well for a lot of people.
Yeah. So the second amendment to the Seattle Public Library budget is $1.7 million to provide air conditioning to the Northeast and Southwest branch libraries so they can be used as additional cooling spaces when the city suffers heat waves, like we did this past summer. So the money for that did make it into the budget, and that's also a very, very good idea. Now, the arts budget amendments, there were four original amendments, three of which are included in the balancing package. $1.5 million for neighborhood arts organizations that are struggling to recover from the pandemic lockdown. That was Tammy Morales who proposed that. $1 million for facilities operators who don't qualify for federal relief funds through the Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program. These are for cultural facilities that don't have fixed seating. So you have to have fixed seating to qualify for that federal funding. So particularly museums, for example, the Northwest African American Museum and the Nordic Heritage Museum don't have fixed seating, so they couldn't get federal funding.
Yeah, a lot of music venues don't either.
Yeah, a lot of music venues are standing room only, so they don't qualify either. And then $50,000 to restore the mural at the Northeast 63rd Street underpass with Aurora. That was Dan Strauss. Get a little money there to clean up graffiti and to repaint a mural that is kind of a nice amenity for the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's over by Woodland Park Zoo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The next step in the budget process will be for the council to actually meet and discuss the balancing package. They typically negotiate and make changes to the amendments during that process. They may bring up additional amendments and then vote on the amendments. They expect to do that over the next week, week and a half, and to have a final budget package to vote on before Thanksgiving. So that's the next step in the budget process. You can always go to the City Council's website and sign up to listen to or give testimony at the city budget hearings.
I don't think you need to sign up if you're just going to listen.
Yeah, if you're just going to listen, you don't need to sign up. But if you want to give testimony, it's a good idea to sign up ahead of time. In fact, yeah, you have to. So.
Yeah, and there's always a lot of demand for those trials. So.
There is.
Get there early.
Yes, and be patient.
Yes.
All right. Well, that takes us on to this week's COVID-related news.
Yeah, we are seeing in Washington State, as well as in the country, an uptick in new cases. That's not surprising as people move indoors for the winter and the weather turns. We had 130,000 new cases in the United States yesterday, which is an extremely high number. This pandemic is not over. It's not over by a long shot. The vast majority of those cases are of unvaccinated people, of course, but you know, we're still in the pandemic. You should still be taking precautions. Wear masks in indoor spaces. You know, practice social distancing. All those things that we've unfortunately learned over the last couple of years.
Let's talk about a guy who didn't do any of those things.
Yes, Senator Doug Erickson, who was the state chair of the Trump reelection campaign. He has been, you know, noisily insisting that the vote was somehow rigged for the last year. And he tested positive for COVID.
He's been a rabid anti-vaxxer here in the state of Washington and very much against the pandemic lockdown from the start.
Now, the reason that his positive test came to light is he is trying to get treatment for his infection, but he's in El Salvador, which does not have advanced COVID treatments. Now, what was he doing in El Salvador? That is an excellent question. Bear in mind that state representatives and senators, those are part-time positions, and those folks are expected to work when legislature is not in session. Which is really a throwback to, you know, the agrarian society that the state constitution was devised around in the 19th century. But Erickson has a consulting business, and his consulting business seems to involve a lot of countries with, what's the technical term? I believe it's fascist governments.
Repressive governments, yes.
Yes. And so, he was in El Salvador. And somehow got COVID. He is almost certainly not vaccinated himself, and probably wasn't wearing a mask, etc. And so now he's stranded in El Salvador and can't get the advanced, you know, monoclonal antibody treatment that is seen on the right wing as the cure all for COVID. It's not, it can help, but it's no substitute for, you know, public health precautions and not actually getting infected in the first place.
Yeah. I want to point out that Erickson sponsored a bill in the Washington State Senate this year, Senate Bill 5144, to protect the rights of people who refuse to get vaccinated. But fortunately, the bill never made it out of committee. It appears now that Erickson has really taken seriously the anti-science stance of his party. He didn't get vaccinated, it appears. He got on a plane, which is a very high-risk activity, without getting vaccinated first, and is now really suffering the expected outcome. And
how did he get on the plane without being vaccinated?
I know. That's a very good question. And I think it really points out the hypocrisy of the Republican Party, you know, being so selective in their anti-science attitude. You know, monoclonal antibodies are okay, but your own natural antibodies that your body makes in response to a vaccine are somehow not okay, right? That's essentially what the Republican Party is saying in you should refuse the vaccine, but you should definitely demand the Regeneron monoclonal antibodies when you do fall ill and are seriously ill and hospitalized. Of course, he was down in El Salvador to do what he likes, what he, you know, gets paid to do as a political consultant, which is, oversee and certify elections. Erickson has chosen to do that for repressive governments that other members of his own party won't even consider doing that kind of work for these governments because they know they'll be certifying an election that was not fair. So that shows you how extreme Erickson is.
Well, except that it means that Erickson has a lot of experience with witnessing vote fraud.
Yeah, he does. So I found that to be quite interesting this week, that the leading critic of vaccines here in Washington State is now sick, hospitalized in a country where he can't rely on the one bit of science that the Republican Party accepts and is now begging someone in his party to somehow get hold of a prescription medication, you know, and fly it down to him ASAP. I just don't think that's going to happen.
No. And NBC News had an interesting report this week on the latest trend among anti-vaxxers, which is that because the vaccine mandates are proving very effective in sort of, you know, impelling people who wouldn't otherwise get vaccinated to get vaccinated to save their jobs. Mm-hmm. Now on the far right, you can buy treatments that will help rid your body of the vaccine. Of course, this is like, you know, the latest grift, basically. There are things
that's
like...
I can tell you right off the bat, that's a scam.
Of course it is. So,
anybody who knows anything about science knows that's a scam.
Apparently many people who are like, you know, anti-vaxxers don't know a lot about science.
Pretty,
so
when it comes
to science. My favorite was the bat that you can soak in and it will... I mean, this is like 19th century, ridding your body of the bad humors, right?
Right.
This goes back
to the Dark Ages in Europe.
Totally. And if you take a bath and put Epsom salt and baking soda and a couple other things in there, it will somehow rid your body of the vaccine.
Make you really relaxed.
Yeah. And
it will do and, right for a good night's sleep.
Yeah. Now, there might be a microchip left over, but you'll still have to deal with that. It's really hard to tell the stupid. I mean, none of it is internally consistent, but that's not the point.
So let's talk a little bit about the effectiveness of vaccines. If you look at vaccination rates in Washington State, here in King County, we've reached 83.7% fully vaccinated with 89.4%, almost 90% who've received at least one dose. And that's really great. Now, among people who are 50 years or older, vaccination rates are over 90% and approaching 100% for people over age 70. And we are seeing far fewer deaths here in King County than in other areas of the state. The lowest vaccination rates, even here in King County, are for young adults ages 20 to 29 years old who are at 70% vaccinated. They're also the age range most likely to be hospitalized and die of COVID-19 in King County because they have the lowest vaccination rate. So it really tells you something about how effective the vaccines are. And of course, this can vary from county to county. In Pierce County, just to the south of us, only about 54% of people age 18 to 34 are vaccinated. So a little over half of them. And I'm sure our hospitals here in King County are probably seeing some of those patients from Pierce County.
And 18 to 34 in Pierce County includes people in the military bases.
Mm-hmm.
And the military is, you know, under orders to get vaccinated, but there's a lot of resistance within the military. And we're going to hear more about that as that deadline approaches next month.
Yeah, yeah. So another example of this, too, is over in Whitman County where Pullman is, and that's where Washington State University is over in Pullman. The vaccination rate for 18 to 34-year-olds is 26.8%, and that is shockingly low. That's like a little over 1 in 4 young people. And if we look at COVID-19 positive case counts in Whitman County, we see that they bottom out in the summer of this year when school's not in session, and then they spiked again in October, and they've been at high rates throughout the winter. Last winter, they're probably going to hold at high rates throughout this winter as well, just because of the very low vaccination rate at Washington State University.
What we saw last year was after November 1st, case rates went up exponentially, especially with Thanksgiving and holiday travel. And I fully expect to see that again this year.
Yeah, here in King County, case rates spiked in December and January because of holiday travel, right? And then they bottomed out in July, spiked briefly in August when the lockdown was lifted and people began dining indoors again. But since then, they've been trending downward just here in King County. And I think that's because of our higher vaccination rates. So the vaccines really, really work. And are very helpful.
Yeah, and we saw a new study that just came out, I believe yesterday, that that shows that booster shots dramatically improve protection against COVID. So it's like above 95% efficacy for Moderna or Pfizer. The states of California and Colorado approved booster shots for everybody age 18 plus. This week. The country of Canada also approved it for all people 18 plus. And the science is rapidly moving in that direction. So I expect to see the CDC approve that very soon as well.
Now, I'm hearing a lot about supply chain issues and how the economy is feeling the effects. And I've been feeling the effects, like everyone, of placing orders, of trying to get things that are back ordered, things that are not in stock, or you order something and it takes over a month for you to receive it because of shipping delays. Now, in the past 18 months, over 5.1 million people have died of COVID-19. And that's a conservative estimate.
That's worldwide,
That's worldwide, yeah. And estimates tell us that a significant number of them were in their prime productive years from age 45 to 75. Okay. That means that the world is missing probably millions of people who have a lot of experience building, making, growing, shipping, and delivering the things we need and take for granted. It's not like we could have a worldwide pandemic that wouldn't affect the supply chain in some way. So it's not a mystery why we are having shortages and supply chain issues. But if you read the business press, you listen to TV news programs, it's as if it's a complete mystery, right? Or the newscasters or reporters blame it on having a Democrat in the White House.
I blame it on truckers.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, if the stock market's doing great, capitalism should be chugging along just fine in all aspects. But, you know, capitalism assumes that people are interchangeable, like parts in a machine. And we know that that is absolutely not true. And that right now we're feeling the effects of losing experienced workers and skilled laborers worldwide. Okay. And the pandemic, as you said, Jav, is still going on. Deaths worldwide total between 7,000 to 8,000 people per day. That's a lot of experience that we're losing every day.
And right now.
And these are conservative estimates, not necessarily full number.
And right now, by far the worst place in the world is Europe, especially Eastern Europe, because the vaccination rates are relatively low there. But Europe is really important to the global economy. It's a manufacturing center, second only to China. And, you know, we are heavily interdependent with Europe for trade. Right now, a lot of countries in Europe have very high new case rates, particularly in Eastern Europe, Russia, Ukraine, Poland, countries like that that have relatively low vaccination rates are seeing very high case rates. And, you know, the EU has been dependent on Eastern European labor for years now to you know, help its economy chug along. Germany also has very high case rates, and of course that's a manufacturing center.
Yeah, so, you know, we can talk about deaths, but think of the millions, literally 46 million here in the United States who have fallen ill with COVID and are struggling with things like COVID long haul syndrome, which can make it impossible for those people to work for sometimes up to several months after they fall ill, or may appear later, months later after they've recovered. They may suddenly start being hit with fatigue, heart disease issues that they didn't have to deal with before, or breathing or continuing breathing problems that make it impossible for them to work or be as productive as they were previously. So this idea that there are enough human beings to keep the economy chugging along as normal in spite of a massive worldwide pandemic is, I think, something that I find impossible to understand why you know, business analysts have that expectation, but it's built into capitalism.
I want to talk also about the massive media hand-wringing over an alleged labor shortage. And of course, COVID has a lot to do with that. The other thing that's not getting attention that has a lot to do with that, immigration was cut in half in the U.S. under Donald Trump. And that has a lot to do with labor shortage, particularly in farms and manufacturing. You know, we cut off our supply of cheap labor, and suddenly we wonder where all the people willing to do cheap labor have gone. It's not a mystery where they are.
That's true.
They're just not let into the country.
Yeah, so, a lot of immigrants do jobs like delivery. Okay. Like helping to move people around when you need to get from point to point. Helping to make or process or produce the food that you typically eat. So when food prices go up, when there are shortages, when you can't get something delivered on time, you know, you can look to the Trump administration. You can partially look to COVID-19, but you can look also to the Trump administration's very stupid efforts to cut off the supply of new immigrants into the United States.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I want to mention also a federal judge this week ruled on Wednesday that Governor Greg Abbott in Texas, his ban on mask mandates in Texas schools, violated the rights of students with disabilities and was therefore overturned. So school districts in Texas can now implement mask mandates, or at least try to, you know, without interference from the state government. That was good news for the, you know, 29 million people of Texas. Texas is about to pass California for the most deaths in the country, even though Texas also has 11 million fewer people in it. And that is directly traceable to the policies of the Republican administration, the Republican legislature there. We are now seeing, you know, the deaths and new cases in Trump voting counties across the U.S., having passed those of the Democratic counties. The Democratic counties had a higher rate for a long time because of the massive pandemic that hit New York City early on.
And population density.
And population density, yes. Mm-hmm. But that has changed now. And it has specifically changed because the Republican Party has for some reason politicized public health measures and come out strongly against public health measures. It's incredibly reckless and really pretty sociopathic.
And very much like the Dark Ages.
Yeah, very much
understanding of what public, and a misunderstanding of what public health measures actually mean.
Yeah. I mean, I'm surprised that the Florida Department of Health is not engaging in, like, you know, bleeding with leeches.
Yeah.
it really is very discouraging for those of us who, like, you know, have a passing education or may actually think that science is based on, you know, results that can be replicated, and therefore is not a a voodoo practice. It is in fact you know, very logical and is responsible for most of our modern conveniences. But you know, you won't hear Republicans say any of that.
All right. Well, we'll be returning to that subject next week.
Yeah, we will. Happy holidays.
Meanwhile, D.C. and January 6th.
Yeah, the Trump crime family had a bad legal week this week. Yesterday, Steve Bannon was charged by the Department of Justice with two counts of obstructing a congressional investigation for his refusal to show up in response to the subpoenas of the January 6th Select Committee in the House. Meantime, Mark Meadows did not show up for his scheduled deposition, and he has been threatened by Committee Chairman Benny Thompson of Mississippi with being next. The DOJ measure is really important as a precedent because a number of Trump people are claiming executive privilege, which we saw in a lawsuit this week that Donald Trump filed to try and prevent the National Archives from releasing his documents around January 6th and, you know, phone records, things like that. The judge in that case said, you know, we don't have executive privilege in perpetuity. We don't have kings. We have elected presidents. And moreover, the plaintiff is not president anymore. And the Biden administration has said that they are happy to waive executive privilege for those particular documents. So so that was thrown out by the courts. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of Trump's acolytes, and we had 14 more subpoenas issued by the Select Committee this week, including some very high-profile names. The two Millers, Jason Miller, who was installed as the head of the Pentagon after the election, and Stephen Miller, who's everybody's favorite neo-Nazi, Michael Flynn, who's everybody's second favorite neo-Nazi, John Eastman, who authored the legal justification that Trump was using to try and justify a coup d'etat. And the question is, who asked Eastman to draft that document? We don't know. So his testimony in particular would be very useful, assuming he's willing to testify and he's willing to testify truthfully. But we're seeing it's been nearly a year since the events of January 6th this year. It's hard to believe that we're in the same calendar year where Trump was president once, but how quickly we forget. And certainly Trump has not gone away. He continues to fundraise. He continues to claim that the election was somehow fraudulent, you know, which is the big lie. There's no evidence for it whatsoever. A solid percentage of Republican voters believe that, and it's become an article of faith among Republican office holders. It really is a fantasy world that they're living in, but a very dangerous fantasy world, because the precedent is that they will never accept an election result that they don't like in the future, and that spells the end of democracy. So, you know, we'll see what happens next year with the midterms.
Christian, we have Republicans in the Republican Party who believe that election results should be whatever the person in power can make them be, right? I mean, that's what Doug Erickson does. He flies around the world to certify election results for governments that manipulate their elections. It's not a surprise then that the Republicans in the National Party are the same way. They feel that American elections should be run the same way.
Yeah. And it really, I mean, if that takes hold, it really is the end of democracy as we know it. You know, as flawed as American democracy has been, it can get a lot worse. Mm-hmm. And that danger is very present. So be aware and don't get complacent.